from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. President Barack Obama Monday issued a presidential executive order calling the government of Venezuela a threat to U.S. national security and declaring a national emergency to deal with alleged human rights violations and corruption in that South American country. The news comes less than a month after the country's socialist president, Nicolas Maduro, on February 12th, announced the breakup of a coup attempt by a group of right-wing opposition figures, acting in coordination with several rogue military officers and, he said, coordinated by Washington, which would have removed the country's elected government and replaced it with a U.S.-backed regime. That plot was uncovered by Venezuelan intelligence officials, aided by a group of young army officers loyal to the government. The evidence obtained included confessions of several of the detained officers, as well as weapons and computers containing details of the plan, its authors, and its financing. Some of those involved, including military aviation officers who were to coordinate aerial attacks against a number of targets inside the capital city, Caracas, are in the hands of the courts, where the investigation continues. For more, we spoke with journalist Fernando Velasquez, producer of the daily Spanish-language news program Informativo Pacifica, by telephone from Los Angeles.
What's going on right now with Venezuela? What do you think it means that President Obama signed this declaration of national emergency?
Well, this is an ongoing battle of Washington to destabilize and to remove the government of Venezuela and place it with perhaps a guy named Enrique Capriles. They've been trying so hard. I understand the Zionist Association of Venezuela is very solid behind them. He started with Hugo Chavez. They couldn't remove him. Well, they removed him for, as you know, for 2 days, and then he returned to power thanks to the Venezuelan people. Then when he passed away, or when some will argue, when Chavez was assassinated by the U.S. government, they thought once the figure of Chavez was gone, that they could easily take over Venezuela because the charismatic Chavez was getting in the way. Because Nicolás Maduro was left in charge by Hugo Chavez, he said, "I want you to run for office." Before he left, he told the Venezuelan people, "This is my man, this is my son, vote for him, because we have a plan to rebuild Venezuela, and he has the instructions to carry out my orders." And, of course, the Venezuelan people voted for Nicolás Maduro. Well, they could not, the right wing, Ricky Capriles and his friends in Washington and Tel Aviv could not get rid of Nicolás Maduro via the electoral struggle. They lost the election. So what was left? A green revolution, a color revolution, a kind of like what they applied, they just tried to apply it against Syria in the early stages in 2011. They started what is called the Guarimbas, violent demonstrations led by some involvement of the U.S. government and the their associates and the Colombian paramilitaries in association with Álvaro Uribe, former president of Colombia, and some participation of Mexican right-wingers who had already trained and developed some of the cadre that will go back to Venezuela to overthrow the government. They have not succeeded. So what is left? Some of the people who was involved in the attempt to destabilize and overthrow the President Maduro, there was plenty of evidence, emails, interviews, conversations on the phone, the overwhelming amount of evidence that led to the leadership of the attempt to overthrow the government in conjunction with the U.S. government. So they started arresting people, and the latest was the arrest of a local mayor, Before him, it was one of the leaders of the Guarimbas, the violent demonstrations. So once their key players on the chessboard were arrested and detained and facing trial, what is left for Washington? Well, overthrowing the government. Well, if they cannot do it through a third party, well, they're going to do it themselves. Now they need to build the manufactured consent, support from the U.S. people to support an invasion, and that's probably what they're working on right now. My take is that's what Barack Obama's doing right now.
Does the U.S. have the forces in place to accomplish a rapid invasion of Venezuela? And what do you think the people of Venezuela would do?
Well, they saw it even when Chavez, before Hugo Chavez was gone, they begin to mobilize to create a militia force following a very detailed, very profound asymmetrical warfare to counter any invading force that was created under Chavez. And as we speak, on the U.S. side, they have introduction of U.S. Military forces in Peru. They have some in Colombia. They have some next door in one of the little European colonies they have next door to Venezuela. They have in Costa Rica and Panama. They have in Puerto Rico and El Salvador. So Venezuela is clearly surrounded by military forces from the U.S. waiting for the green light to move in. On the Venezuelan side, well, they have UNASUR, whatever that may mean. There's resistance from UNASUR nations, namely Ecuador, Bolivia, Argentina, Brazil, ready to support Venezuela any way they can. The Venezuelans are ready with their asymmetrical warfare self-defense mechanism, and I guess the ball is in the Barack Obama's court now.
And there have been both the Russian and Chinese officials touring over the last year several times the entire region, including visits to Caracas. Do you see any possibility of action either at the UN or in terms of military assistance coming from either of those quarters to help Venezuela defend against an invasion?
Well, I mean, just for a moment, let's take a look at the global scene. The United States has been putting a lot of emphasis in encircling China and Russia to make sure that they don't move out to support any of their allies and friends anywhere, risking that they might suffer a blow from the surrounding U.S. so-called anti-missile defense systems, which are also very offensive. The world is a chessboard because of what the alliance, the partnership, the relationship that China and Russia have with Venezuela. Chances are there will be some activity at the United Nations, at the Security Council. The United States is probably going to have to go against the Russians and the Chinese at the Security Council. So what? They will do it unilaterally. Barack Obama said it at least twice. Barack Obama will act unilaterally when the interests of the United States and its friends and allies are in danger. So he will go outside the United Nations to do what he must do if he really wants to do it. So what is left? Well, it remains to be seen.
The president's executive order said that he reached a finding that the situation in the country, quote, constitutes an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States, and I hereby declare a national emergency to deal with that threat, closed quote. Some of the details of last month's coup were certain to embarrass the administration in the anticipated court proceedings. According to the Venezuelan president, the coup was to unfold in three phases. The first, publication of a program of a transitional government in print, followed by a second phase with an attack by a fighter plane on the president's palace and more than a dozen other places, including government offices and the central station of Telesur, the public media organization, while the third phase would be publication of a video of a general who would report that a military force had revolted against President Nicolas Maduro and overthrown him. We will continue to follow this story as it develops. The ceasefire in Ukraine continues to hold. Germany's foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, told reporters Monday during a visit to Romania that the violence had been reduced significantly following the Minsk II peace agreement brokered on February 12th. Steinmeier also pointed Friday to the, quote, clear reduction of violence, closed quote, before senior officials from Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France met in Berlin to discuss the next steps needed to implement the peace accord. According to the UN Human Rights Office, more than 6,000 people have died in eastern Ukraine since the beginning of the conflict almost a year ago. The widely televised images of ISIS arriving in the heart of cities across Iraq and parts of Syria in a fleet of identical, shiny new Toyota pickups have left some wondering if, instead of the stereotypical Allah Akbar coming from the mouths of arriving troops, if perhaps the slogan might be better presented as, you asked for it, you got it. But who is funding ISIS? We begin with this report from Press TV's Shakufik Ranjbar.
Months after taking parts of Syria and Iraq and creating its so-called caliphate, ISIL is known as one of the richest terror groups in the world. ISIL represents a new form of terrorist organization where funding is central to its activities. Its primary sources of revenue are mainly derived from illicit proceeds from its occupation of territory. They include bank looting and extortion, control of oil fields and refineries, as well as kidnapping for ransom. ISIL also earns money from looting and smuggling antiquities and then taxing the looters. According to a November report by the UN, ISIL raises several million dollars a month from illegal taxation. The terrorist group also raises up to $123,000 a day from ransom payments and more than $1.5 million of revenue from crude oil sales a day. Earlier this year, the UN Security Council passed a resolution banning all trade of antiquities from Syria and putting sanctions on anyone buying oil from ISIL. This was the first international measure to stem the ISIL's revenues. However, many are saying that more is needed to be done to determine the most effective countermeasures to stop ISIL's funding. Experts say in terrorists' order for ISIL to make more money, it needs to occupy more territory. This highlights the need to prevent the Takfiri group from taking more areas through military operations. The Iraqi and Syrian government forces have been engaged in fierce clashes with ISIL over the past month. The battles are considered to be difficult, partly due to measures taken by a number of countries, including Turkey. Ankara has been under fire from outside and inside Turkey for its direct and indirect cooperation with ISIL. Among other things, the country has so far resisted calls to join the international campaign against the terrorist group. It is also criticized for not placing border restrictions to prevent the flow of arms and militants to and from Syria. Many observers maintain that alongside military operations and measures to stem the terrorists' source of income, a halt to direct and indirect support for them can play a major role in defeating the group, which poses a global threat.
Sukant Chandan is a political commentator based in London who specializes in Middle East affairs. He spoke with Press TV's Marzi Hashimi this past weekend on the program The Debate about the sources of funding and arms behind the terrorist group.
What we're faced when we're dealing with ISIS is basically an ideological movement that has its roots in the Saudi version or perversion of Islam, and Saudi Arabia only exists historically because the British teamed up with Ibn Wahab and the Saud family and instituted that state through genocide and massacres, actually. And that state, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf monarchies only continue to exist in the Second World War period when their historical alliance with the British, who keep them afloat, was then joined and in some ways was surpassed by the new patrons of the Gulf monarchies, which is the United States of America. We fast forward to the Iraqi resistance post the war of aggression and invasion of Iraq by primarily the United States and the UK regimes. And then we had Al-Qaeda 2.0 in the form of the Zarqawi-led franchise of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And what Zarqawi's leadership and evolution, however depraved evolution it was, which it was, what it did, it sought to achieve for the British and the Americans and their regional allies the dividing, the tragic and traumatic dividing of the Iraqi resistance, which until then had some semblance of unity, particularly between the Sunni and Shia resistance forces. And what we've seen since then is that the Arab monarchies, as well as the usurping Zionist state of so-called Israel, and also the Turkish state, a leading NATO power, but along with its primary patrons in London, Paris, and Washington, has used ISIS and other death squad formations as well, such as Nusra and many others, to maintain not only the status quo in the interest of their hegemony, but importantly to deliver all their strategic interests and aims. Okay. No strategic interest of the West has been negatively impacted by ISIS.
Here in the U.S., the militarization of police continues to make waves as the Department of Justice decides whether to bring charges of racial discrimination against the police force in Ferguson, Missouri. Telesur's Alexandra Hall spoke with activists in Washington, D.C. about police conduct in the nation's capital.
If you're a young man of color in Washington, D.C., you know that when men with guns jump out of an unmarked car and start asking you questions, you don't move.
I was originally thinking, we're being carjacked or robbed. Whoever these guys are, they're going to shoot me in the back if I start running or chase me and beat me. And so just kind of toughed it out to... There was really nothing else to do. They were armed, we weren't.
Those guys were police, and the tactic was a jump out. Although not officially acknowledged by D.C. police, they're consistently reported in Washington, D.C.'s African American and Latino neighborhoods. The ACLU, which is investigating such incidents, finds that they're often aggressive, rarely result in arrest, and almost always go undocumented.
You have every year more than 45,000 arrests, and 96% of them are for nonviolent offenses. Over 80% of the overall arrests are of black people, despite black people making up only 50%. Of the population.
The local signs of a nationwide problem. The Department of Justice has said it's considering a lawsuit against the Ferguson Police Department following the death of Michael Brown and months of protests, where activists pointed out the use of military equipment to control crowds.
The militarization of police in this country has gone far beyond military-grade equipment and really permeates into the culture and the tactics and the strategies that are employed in this war on drugs, which is essentially a war on black and brown communities.
A petition against jump outs in the nation's capital is now gaining support, but the relationship between law enforcement and some families in the United States is already damaged.
Well, statistically speaking, as a black male, every 28 hours, it could be me that could be the next hashtag police security or otherwise vigilante like George Zimmerman. So I have zero trust in our law enforcement agency.
As those personally affected take steps to outlaw such tactics, authorities risk alienating a generation of young men and women who don't trust the police. Alexandra Hall, Washington, D.C., Telesur.
On June 14, 2012, Lorenzo Johnson, whose wrongful conviction was finally overturned by a federal court, turned himself in to go back to prison, again serving out a sentence of life without parole for a murder in 1995 that he insists he did not commit. In this third installment of the investigation into his case, we spoke with Lorenzo Johnson this past Sunday about some of the details of the legal papers his lawyers filed this past Friday in their latest effort to undo that Supreme Court decision, reinstating his conviction, and seeking a new trial. So there are 4 points, and I want to go through these things here to make sure that I understand what's being said. The first point has to do with Carla Brown, the witness, and that she had made a written statement prior to giving testimony at the trial, and the written statement disagrees with what she said in the written statement to the detectives, disagrees on the basic facts from what she testified to at trial. And there's a dispute. The other side says, yeah, we gave it to you. So the lawyers that handled the trial said first they don't remember seeing it. It's not in their file. They had written to you asking for copies of all statements and...
No, I wrote to them asking for a copy.
Oh, right, and they said that she did not make a written statement before trial, right?
Exactly.
Okay, and that it wasn't used in the trial. But they also say there's this objective proof that Brown's statement was never marked or identified on the trial record, and that during the whole career of this public defender's lawyer, they always submit the written statements because they use it when they interrogate the witness on the stand saying, okay, here's Exhibit A, didn't you tell us
this
blah, blah, blah.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Didn't you tell us blah, blah, blah. Do I have that right?
That's accurate.
Okay, so that's the first point. Now, then we have Victoria Dubes, is that how you say it?
Dubes.
Okay, she was a witness. What did she testify to?
She was originally one of my alibi witnesses that was with me in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess she started hanging with another crowd of people and got locked up. And once she got locked up, they used her as a motive witness to go against me.
Gotcha. And then it turns out that the assigned detective, Kevin Duffin, had a close family-like relationship with her, which
was
also...
brother. They lived in the same house.
They were what? It's her what?
At one time, they lived in the same house. That was her godbrother. So, you know, we never knew this close family tie. So now, you know, it makes sense. Why did she change her original statement?
Right. She had somebody that could help her make a deal to get out of the trouble she was in.
She got a deal 7 days after my trial.
Wow. All right. Then there's a statement from the former detective, Dillard. What was Dillard's role in the trial?
See, what happened
this
was...
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Detective Dillard, he was one of the detectives that was investigating the case.
Mm-hmm.
And our whole thing was, we knew that Carla Brown was at that police station that night. And they always said that she wasn't at the police station that night and that she made a statement later on. But she slipped up at the preliminary hearing and said that when she first talked to the police, she lied to them. She told them flimflams that she wasn't there. So we was wondering, where's that record when you first talked to them? And now, 19 years later, we found out from Detective Diller that she was not only in the police station that night, but they worked on her for 4 months for her to tell the truth. So our whole thing is, where are the reports that she was telling you for the 4 months she was working on her?
Right. Because apparently they didn't agree with the testimony
exactly.
that she gave. And so they had 4 months, basically, of helping her get her story together.
Exactly.
Okay, and then finally, so those are the points, basically, that support the 4 points in the affidavit. All right, so you submitted the papers on Friday. What are we doing next?
Right now, we're waiting for the judge to make a hearing date for everything. Because, you know, in the Commonwealth, the Attorney General, they kept saying that, you know, they had an open file policy that, you know, and they tried to quote off the records, you know, but what happened was they never turned this material over to us or the lawyers. So for all these years, you know, they was using the record fighting me about this, and now here it is, the lawyers themselves that filed for the discovery wrote affidavits and showed that they've been trying to get that discovery and that they was not turning over. They were unsuccessful. So it shows back then that it was a malicious prosecution.
Oh, and also, one of the other items here is there was, in fact, a cover letter from the DA's office to your trial lawyer listing all these items that were being transmitted, and these documents, the missing 9 pages, were not, and the earlier statements from this witness were not included in the transmittal.
Carla Brown's statement was never in anything part of the record. You know, it wasn't introduced as evidence in the court at trial. When the Attorney General sent, you know, the cover letter for all the witnesses' statements, the discovery he was sending, her statement and her name was not listed on it either.
Let me remind people of why you were in prison. There was a murder. You were accused of being present and an accomplice and convicted of that. And that was based on what?
That was based on Carla Brown saying that I was present before the murder took place, that I was standing there.
And in the statements...
if I could be a lookout.
And in the statements that were not submitted to you until very recently, that were not part of the trial,
she had, there were written statements of her testimony
totally
to the police.
Totally opposite of what she said at trial. And the prosecutor sat there from my early stages for 19 years, let this false testimony go by without stepping in saying that this testimony is wrong, that she's saying this is not the testimony from the affidavit she had gave us. This took one off my preliminary hearing to my trial, my direct appeal, my post-conviction relief appeal. It went on to my federal appeal all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. Used her testimony at trial to bring me back to prison after my conviction was vacated. They used this false testimony. Not once has the prosecutor in good faith said, no, this ain't right. This was said that this, what you're making a part of the record is not accurate. So basically, it was a fraud all along.
And then, you didn't get it until after you were reincarcerated after the Supreme Court?
I didn't get it until a couple months ago.
Wow.
And this is going on the 20th year now.
So that's the person that places you there. The person that gives
you... That's the only witness to this case.
Right. And then there was a witness as to motive who said she was with you in a bar
exactly.
or something. And that person had originally said you were in New York.
Exactly.
Wow, that's the whole case against you, and you're still in prison. If you're
still in prison. My appeal is in front of my trial judge, and, hopefully, what's right take place, and they're right that's wrong, But at the very minimum, it should be a couple hearings, for what's going on right now.
And then your lawyers say in the pleadings that this case here is over the procedural, wrongdoing, and that there should be a new trial on that basis. And of course, now the only case that they have would be impeached there. But your lawyer also says that they have evidence that you're innocent, which they're not presenting now because it's not necessary. What is that evidence, or can you talk about that yet?
See, because what happened is this detective, Kevin Duffin, he threatened a lot of witnesses not to come and fall for me. Like, my girlfriend at the time that I was staying with out here knew I was in New York, and I had called from New York when I was in New York around this time frame, and he went to see her, and he kept threatening her not to come forth. She said, check my phone records. It showed that he was in New York when he called me. He wasn't here. We was living together. He threatened to take her kids and give her false charges not to come forth, and that she's not the only one. We had a couple of witnesses that was on the trial stand that said that he was trying to do the same to them.
So now those people are not within the reach of the police because the children are grown or whatever they had
exactly.
hanging over them.
So now
they can
all
testify.
The time later, they feel to come forth, but at the same time, in 2013, the Attorney General's office who prosecutes the case said they was going to investigate my innocent claims and my corruption claims. And for 2 years, they act like they was doing that, and in reality, they wasn't doing that. So when it was time for them to file their reply, they didn't stand on the evidence. What they did was they ran behind procedural default and the timeliness that, has expired for me to file my appeal. So if you're looking for somebody's innocence, why would you do that?
Right. Yeah, they were hanging the earlier case on. They were saying you were time barred from bringing these claims now and
exactly.
all of this.
They blamed me. Literally, they blamed me for them hiding evidence for 19 years.
Wow.
They blamed that I didn't find the evidence sooner. And they blamed me for this.
Okay, and suppose you're unsuccessful with this appeal. What happens next?
We go to the next stage as far as the Superior Court.
And if this entire line of inquiry is shut down,
one thing for sure in Pennsylvania, life is life. It's not like other states; it's natural life in Pennsylvania. And, if you don't have no new evidence to bring you in, to show your innocence, it's the procedures here is so strict. Unlike, say, New York, where there's no time limit for newly discovered evidence, if you can show your innocence, Pennsylvania will give you 60 days to file that evidence. If you don't file it within 60 days, they'll argue, time bar and stuff like that you can't file your appeal. So it ain't about being innocent no more. It's about if you can file before the timeline. And this is what they did. This is what they're trying to do with me. But we have shown now that, it's not possible.
We will continue to discuss this case in depth over the next few weeks with Lorenzo Johnson from the Frackville, Pennsylvania prison where he is currently held.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.